2004 death in a French military hospital. She reportedly plans to file a legal complaint. Yesterday, Palestinian authorities gave final approval for Arafat's body to be exhumed as part of an investigation into whether he was poisoned. Switzerland's Institute of Radiation Physics had detected elevated traces of the rare polonium-210 on Arafat's belongings. Former Israeli leader Ehud Olmert is cleared of the most serious charges anyway in his corruption trial. However, the court has convicted him on one count of breach of trust. Olmert is expected to be sentenced in September. He is also standing trial in a separate real estate bribery case. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, open for breakfast and lunch this summer from Tuesday through Friday. Staffed and managed by students, Bevere Cafe is located in Bevere Hall at Goodwin and Gregory on campus. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Well, I am very pleased this morning to be talking with Belva Davis. She is someone that, if you're interested in the history of broadcast journalism, you certainly should know her name. And if you lived on the West Coast, you would certainly know her name. She's been working in television in the Bay Area for a long time and is well known in Northern California. She is was the first black woman to work in television on the West Coast. Actually, I think even in the Western United States.
Yeah.
That after having worked in radio and also in print. She has talked with a host of notable people of the 20th century. She's won six regional Emmys. She won the Lifetime Achievement Award of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and now works for the public television station in San Francisco, KQED, where she has hosted now for 19 years the program This Week in Northern California, and actually recently announced that she would be retiring, and I think in the fall, in November, you'll be doing your last show.
Right.
The last one of those shows.
Right. Isn't it wonderful, though, when you do decide to retire, to set the terms and just when and all of that? It's been great. I'm hoping it's going to make it easier because, you know, we're talking about lifetime habits here now.
Yeah. It's a big change. I know it's a big change. I'd like to talk about some about you first to start out. You were born in Louisiana to a teen mom. I think your mom was just 14.
When she became pregnant, she was 15 by the time I was born.
And then you went to live with an aunt. She died of tuberculosis when you were three.
Yeah, almost four.
And so then you went and you lived with various family members before you ended up in Oakland. So when you think back to when you were a girl, what did you think you might do with your life? Did you think about that?
Well, I am from a family where I was the first in my immediate family to graduate from high school. So I can't say my expectations were, you know, that far flung. For me, if I could have become a teacher, that would have been climbing a huge mountain. And I don't think my aspirations went beyond that. The one thing that had kept me going a lot in life, though, was reading books. And it was from books that I learned about life. And they were my friends and my comfort. And I, oftentimes, as a child, I was somehow got a hold to a little flashlight. And I would take my flashlight in a book. And on my pallet from where I slept on the floor, I would pull the blanket up and I would read in my little tent down there. But people will ask me, well, what did you read? Who are your favorite authors? I said, you know, I don't know. It was the books I could get my hands on. It was what was available to me. And only one book did I read repeatedly, and that was a book called Ramona. And it was about the struggles of a young girl. And I read that, I don't know, for years. I don't know how many times, almost word out reading it. Something I found in it spoke to me personally. And as to what I thought I would do with my life, as I said, it was a lot for me to even envision myself a school teacher. But yeah. That was what I thought I wanted.
Well, I want to – we'll talk some about how it is you managed to work your way up in journalism and working in print and working in radio. And I know you're asked this question a lot. I wish I could think of some different way to ask it, but I'll just go ahead and ask it, particularly when you had been working in radio and then you went and tried to get your first job in television. There weren't any black women mm-hmm. in television. I'm not sure there were any women or very many women at all. Mm-hmm. What was it that made you think that was something that you could do?
The television part was born in a real scene, like a scene from a film. I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I wasn't really so sure what a journalist did. And I remember my best friend is a reference librarian. And I remember, you know, going to the library as we looked up various terms of how I could execute this budding vision of mine. But there was an incident in 1964 where I saw the power of television, and I saw how television journalists, to me at that time, were almost like saviors, because it was through the TV camera shots and the stories reporting from the South of the struggles of the civil rights movement that we began to understand what was going on there. But in this case, I'm at a national party convention in my home city in San Francisco. I'm in a building I've been in before, the Cow Palace. And I'm trying, not because I was a great journalist or knew even what journalism was by then, but I was with a man who was an absolute genius, my news director, a guy named Louis Freeman. And one of the brightest men I've ever met, even up to today, just a great guy. And he decided that we, as two black people, were going to cover the Republican Convention of 1964, one of the most contentious, even by today's standards, political conventions ever heard. And they were at war with the media. And repeatedly, you know, fists would go up in the air, name-calling would happen from the floor with the delegates, but from the galleries around where they were. And one particular night, and I hate to repeat a story that you've heard it before, but it's only because it's true.
I definitely want to hear the story. Okay. People who are listening, I want them to hear the story,
well,
too.
Well, it was a night where we'd been there one night and we'd done all right. And we'd reported on things like the treatment of the black delegates who were there on our air on a black program radio station. But on this night, former President Dwight Eisenhower was a speaker that was supposed to bring peace to all of this. And surely I have a copy of that speech, well-written speech. It even gave a tip to the civil rights movement. But for some reason, President Eisenhower penciled in a portion, a few lines into that speech that was like striking a match with this crowd. When he talked about maudlin criminals with switchblade knives falling on the mercy of liberal judges claiming all kinds of social ills as to their behavior. And it was more than this audience could take. They absolutely went crazy. And soon they discovered my friend Louis Freeman and ourselves in the rafters of the Cow Palace. And a mob came, and that's why a very explosive first line. I don't even say it on air, the first line of my chapter. And they started to yell and scream at us, and soon they started to throw things at us. And they became more aggressive. We did not move fast, but then Louis said, finally, it's time to wrap the cords. This was radio. And get our tape recorder and get out of here. But by then, the assault had risen to the level of bottles and cans. And so when the first can bottle whizzed past my head and hit the concrete floor, that was when I almost lost it. But I think it was a moment where I realized that, if that TV camera had been closer to me, this would really mean something. In my head, I'm thinking this because they would have shown it to people. But as it is now, only people listening to a black radio station are going to know about what happened to us. Well, anyway, I said to Louis on the way home, I want to be one of those guys. I want to be like those guys up there. And he looked at me as a, you know, crazy girl, crazy woman. And but it did, it hit something in me that you could sway opinions, you could bring people knowledge that they would never get otherwise if you could capture it into a well-told story and get it on the air in this country. And so without a college education, without any training, without knowing anybody who'd ever been on television, if you're going to dream, dream big. That's why I said never in my wildest dreams, you know, you just get out there and do it. And I just started applying for jobs.
That's such a great story, and people need to understand that you were there, you and he, you couldn't get press passes,
no.
But he somehow managed to get tickets so that you could get in.
Yes.
So you were there way up in the mm-hmm. up in the high reaches of the place trying to kind of cover it and at the same time keep your heads down. And mm-hmm. I think that the story was that actually nobody else at the station would go. He was going to go. Nobody else would go. So you sort of said, oh, you held up your hands.
Volunteer.
I'll go.
And I tell you, I'm a lifelong volunteer, and I bless all of the people who've spent their lives volunteering, holding up many institutions. But I was a long ago person who would raise my hand to volunteer. And I volunteered, and he knew I wasn't going to bring much to the table except to help carry the equipment.
And was that when you were at
KDIA Lucky 13,
right.
Black program station, you know, rhythm and blues.
And that was, and I know before that you had worked at another station where this was a white-owned station,
mm-hmm.
where you were the first black woman at the station. This was
mm-hmm.
KSAN.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in 1956 you went to work there. They didn't even pay you.
No. But I was, thank God, bright enough to know that I was going to learn something that other people were going to spend a lot of time and money. They let me actually practice and learn my skills on the air because they weren't paying me. And so... I soon had an audience, and I soon had a job offer. But granted, the job offer was to be a clerk, a traffic manager, but with the promise that I could work it out so I'd get on the air one day.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Belva Davis. She's had a long career in journalism on the West Coast. As I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, she was the first black woman in television news in the western United States. This was in San Francisco in the Bay Area. Right now, she works for the public station there, KQED, and is going to, after 19 years, step down as the host of their program this week in Northern California. She'll be doing her last show of that show in November. She's authored a memoir that's titled Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. It's published by Barrett Kohler. It's now out in paperback, if you'd like to read it. She's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, talking with students and talking about her work. And we're recording this interview, so we're not taking calls as we usually do. Your first journalism job, I think, was working as a stringer for Jet Magazine.
Start at the top, right?
And they paid you $5 a week, the princely sum of $5 a week.
There was some logic to that. I lived in the East Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, divided up, you know, by many bridges, and that was enough gas to pay that was enough money to buy me a dollar's worth of gas on the days I had to go there, and 25 cents for the bridge tolls that I would have to pay. So it was really my expense account.
Just your transportation expenses
yes,
to get from your house to work.
Yes.
Well, what sort of things did you do when you were at Jet?
Well, they were very interested in broadening their reach to the West Coast. They didn't have a West Coast correspondent, naturally, or I wouldn't be asked to do that. And I was writing for some small weekly papers, submitting, not writing. I would submit copy, okay? There was no such thing as writing for them. So I started submitting copy to them, and it would be the first black to become a chemistry professor at UC Berkeley, the concert pianist, Lois Toll Caesar, who had just come back from Paris and was now in San Francisco. I would do the Bachelor of the Year, those that I would deem to be great bachelors, or the best-dressed woman. From the, so you can see it was deep journalism.
You talked about the fact that you were the first person in your family to graduate from high school,
mm-hmm.
and you had wanted to go to college and would have gone to San Francisco State, I think, if you had actually had the money to be able to pay the tuition, so you didn't get to go to college. And you went into working in journalism and you learned how to do it by doing it. So having – do you think that it might have been some kind of advantage for you actually that you had not had any formal education in journalism?
No, I don't consider it an advantage. What I consider it though is a push to work harder because I had to compensate for that which I had lost by not being under some smart professor or, other role model to show me the way. But as it was, I learned from people who were actually doing the work. When I was at KSAN, you can't say anything brilliant was happening, but we would clip newspaper stories and every now and then, get a good one at least that was rewritten. So I'd get a little opportunity to do that kind of thing. And when I got into my next stage was because only disc jockeys made money, not people in news. So I got an air show, a radio show, and I became a disc jockey. But I learned it from some of the best in the business, how to breathe, to look in the mirror and watch myself say words and speak to make sure I was enunciating and projecting. And I did it by watching my own facial expressions and how if I seemed to be into it, he knew that I would get better believability coming from within what I was trying to – the story I was trying to tell.
And this was at a time when there were some people who said, oh, well, black people can't be on the radio because they can't speak well enough to be on the radio.
Yes, that's right, that our lips were too thick to pronounce the words we'd be required to pronounce. And that was a true belief by some people. Now, never mind that there were these stations, because they probably never drifted there, on air that were programmed particularly, and I must say they were white-owned, but they were black program for a black audience. And we had a news director who covered all things important to the black community through, what they say, by whatever means necessary. For instance, like with the KSAN, we just, clipped from the newspapers of the day because we certainly didn't have a bureau. We had no wire service. But we did a newscast every hour on the hour.
You've had the opportunity to speak with so many significant people, people who are important in politics and people important in popular culture. And I know that you're called on to keep telling these stories, but there are many great stories. And I'd like to have you tell the story about meeting Frank Sinatra. It seems like that was an early experience and one of those things that maybe when you said to yourself, yes, maybe I can actually do this.
Frank Sinatra is remembered forever and ever because at every moment when I am feeling butterflies in my stomach, Frank Sinatra is on my mind. but I was working for this radio station, KDIA Lucky 13, and for some reason, and probably encouraged by Louis Freeman, the guy who thought nothing was impossible, Frank Sinatra was appearing at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. And I decided I was going to go and get an interview. So I got a little tape recorder and I headed for the Cow Palace and I joined or somehow talked my way into getting into the area where his trailer, his dressing room trailer was, and stood out below the steps there, waiting for him to refresh himself and come out. He came to the door of his trailer, and he looked out at the sea of white male faces and me. I didn't know what was going to happen. So he stood there after the customary drag on the cigarette. Can't forget that. He then held out a hand and took a finger, like calling for, who know who. I'm not sure. And said, "Hey, girly, you." And I looked around.
Like, who me?
Who me? And what other girlies here anyway? And I tell you, the men around me could not believe what had happened. And I was the one invited in to his dressing tent for an interview. But I was so nervous about it. I couldn't even get the cords for the mic undone. And as I sat there with tears, nearly at the top because I'm making a mess of this, he reached out the hand, not with the cigarette, put his hand on mine. And he said to me, "What's the matter?" And I was going, Mr. Sinatra, I'm so glad, but I'm so nervous. And he took a deep breath. And then he said, looking straight at me, he said, the day I walk out on a stage and I'm not nervous is the day I quit. So I don't want to hear any more about nervous. Let's get on. So now when I'm nervous to the degree that I don't know if I'm going to make it, I can reach for my Sinatra hand and know this is part of the game.
That is a fabulous story. That is a fabulous story. Well, you talked about how when you were working at KDIA, then you were at, with the man who was the news director, you were at the Republican National Convention, mm-hmm. at the Cow Palace, the same place where mm-hmm. you had met Frank Sinatra. Then this was the convention where Barry Goldwater was nominated, so in 1964. And it was a time of tremendous upheaval. And you talked about that you really felt that one place that it was possible to have impact was to be in television. So mm-hmm. that's when you said, all right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go for it. So then you went down to the television stations to ask for a job. And I think that the first place that you went was the ABC mm-hmm. station. And they talked to you a little while. And what was it that they told you?
Well, it was my first serious interview. And I'll say that because there had been many other attempts. But this was the first time that I was going to meet with somebody who could actually hire me had they chosen to. And so after polite conversation, and I really didn't know that I was on such soft turf, the very lovely man who had a great reputation in town sort of leaned back in his chair and he says, you know, we're not hiring Negresses right now, but if we ever decide to hire one, we'll certainly consider you. And he said it with all seriousness, and I don't think he knew that he had insulted me.
He certainly wasn't trying to insult you.
No, but, you know, I'm not a tigress or any of those kinds of things. And so I managed to get out of his office without a tear, but with more courage and more determination to move forward along this line and continued pursuing every possible lead that I could.
So then you went to the CBS mm-hmm. affiliate, and there was KPIX. Mm-hmm. So, and you worked there for quite a long time. What do you think it was that whoever it was that you interviewed with and hired you there saw in you that the guy from the other station didn't?
That's a little bit of a story too, because there was a woman there, Nancy Reynolds Clark, who had said to a woman's editor named Mildred Hamilton at the local paper, how much she talked about her admiration for Ronald Reagan, who was then the governor of California. And she said, not then the governor, I mean, was running to become governor. And she said that if he won, that she would hope to get a job working for him. So after the election and the numbers were in and he was declared the winner, on that day I called KPIX to apply for Nancy's job. And, of course, they didn't know anything about this article on the women's page. And they were sort of very sharp with me, saying that Nancy was going nowhere. They didn't know anything about it. Well, long story short, eventually they worked it out. Nancy was called by the Reagans. By then, she hadn't been asked even for a job. But I just wanted to be the first in line. And if she – and I believe that she was sincere – I hadn't really truly realized that they had to ask her. But in any case, they did, and they started – they called me back in for an interview. They didn't stop with just interviewing me. They interviewed almost 70 other women for that position, and in the end, I was selected for the job. Maybe because of my aggressiveness, I'm not sure, but I got the job.
So you – by that time, do you feel like you were a little tougher, at least in the interview – process and communicated better that not only did you really want the job, but you were the person that they should hire?
I had no hesitation in letting them know that I was the person they should hire, because there was something about the environment at that station that was totally different from then. The ABC station was owned and operated by New York at that time. And this was KPIX was an affiliate of CBS. But it was owned by the Westinghouse Broadcasting Company. And they had a reputation for outreaching, for being the kind of company that would give a break. And so I thought I should invest as much time as I could in trying to pursue this one opportunity. Mm. And it did pay off.
So when you're a television reporter, you go out and you don't go out by yourself. You go out with a cameraman. And I'm sure that, well, for a long time, they were men, cameramen. And you have to be bonded with your videographer, or maybe they were shooting film actually then. So that person is real important in your life. You've got to be a good team. But I think at the beginning, you weren't exactly welcomed by the guys that you would have to work with.
And I want to, you know, put their attitude in time and place. We were just getting over the laws that forbid blacks and whites to marry one another. One of their chief concerns is that we automatically, by going down the street together and in our rooms together, we were an interracial couple. And some men were not quite ready to be targeted or labeled or whatever have you in that way. And I heard those kind of words. Mm-hmm. So there were some people who, it just got to be so ridiculous, I think we later laughed about it, who would always find a reason. They'd forget a key, or they'd forget a, not a key, because they'd give me the key to tell me to go to the car, but they'd forget a piece of equipment. They'd have to go back and get it, and would give me the key so that I could go to the car and wait for them. And this happened so often that it was almost hilarious. So they'd find whatever reason. So it was hard for them to get used to the idea that they had to think of me as a person instead of as a color. And eventually it happened.
Yeah.
And thankful to them, my husband became the first black television news cameraman in the state of California, because there was a union rule. You had to have three members sign for you in order to get into the union. And until then, no one in my community knew any people, you know, in the unions to approach them even about signing for someone to enter. And I convinced a couple of those men who had given me a rough time that they could do me a favor by signing Bill's paper. And he had one friend at the station where he got a job, and he had the three signatures and got in. So they became friends.
Yeah. Tell the story about the car chase. This is a story I really like, just to show the kind of adventure that you were in, and maybe also the, I don't know if this qualifies as hazing exactly, but it sounds like some of the men that you worked with really were interested in seeing just how, whether you were going to hang in there or not.
I actually think they really believed all those stories about women, you know, and blood and bodies and all of that, and really thought those things were going to separate me from this dream. But soon after I was there, I didn't know there was a wager in the office. There were bets on how long I would last. And this one guy decided he was going to, you know, play the trump card. So we had this, you know, this call, emergency, police chase. We got in the car with him. Police are chasing after these guys who are shooting at the police. This guy is really a cowboy, Lou Calderon. He whips our car, old Peugeot, around the cop car so that he can get better pictures, he's thinking, because he can't see the whoever these people are in there. And the guys are firing shots.
So you're in between.
We're in between the cops.
The cops and the people who are shooting.
Right. So now he has to figure out, he's got in position, how is he going to get a picture? And he has one of these old Bell and Howell silent cameras. So he gets the camera set up with one hand, and he tells me, his foot is on the gas, and he tells me to grab a hold to the steering wheel. And we continue the chase until the cops, now mad as the dickens with us, manage to get around us again and get behind the bad guys. And he had so many laughs back at the station because he just knew that I was going to fall totally apart. And, you know, I didn't tell on him. He told on himself. Because I didn't want to have to go through explaining why he did that. But his whole idea was that he was going to frighten me so much that, of course, you know, I wouldn't show up the next day or something.
Mm-hmm. I am very happy to be talking in this part of Focus with Belvet Davis, somebody who has had a very long career in journalism, a lot of that in television. She was the first black woman to work in television news on the West Coast, really in the Western United States, and has worked in television now for more than 40 years. Before that, she also worked in print and in radio. She now is on the staff of KQED, the public television station in San Francisco, where she's the host of the program This Week in Northern California, and just fairly recently has announced that she would be retiring, stepping down after doing that for 19 years. Not giving up journalism, but I think stepping down from that job. If you would like to read some more about her and her life, you can look for her book, her memoir, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism, and it's now available in paperback. It's published by Barrett Kohler. She's visiting the campus at the University of Illinois, talking with students and talking about her life and her work, and we're happy to be talking with her. This is a recorded interview, so we're not taking calls as we usually do. So you had the opportunity now working for the television station there to – this was a – again, this was a time of great social upheaval. You covered the Berkeley at the time when it was a hotbed of student radicalism. Mm-hmm. You covered the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. You had the opportunity to know and talk with Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. You met, I think, on more than one occasion, Dr. King. Mm-hmm. What an amazing time to be a journalist and there.
Yes. I was so fortunate. I mean, because this was my community, my life, you know. I mean, there was hardly a star who somehow was not attracted to – people came as observers who didn't even need to be there, wanting to know what it was like to live in that sort of – that power keg of a community. And I was fortunate enough that the need to make me prove myself continued for a very long time. So I got some pretty doggone good assignments, I must say. And I don't know any place right now where the cavalcade of stories and ideas and debate and struggle took place. I mean, things happened all over the country. We all know that. But in Berkeley, you know, just thinking of the issues that came to the front just from the student movement, that's where all of the various studies, that's when the teaching assistants decided to unionize. That's when we had a fight over a piece of real estate and who really owned it, the people of California or the students of the school. That's when the Vietnam War really got, you know, thrashed out. That's when people lost their lives because of their belief, in the peace movement or at least believe in stopping the war. So it was a great time to be growing up. There's no college where I could have received that education, I know, and I consider myself so lucky. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because even though the stories are familiar, if you're old enough for the stories and the title to be familiar, almost always there was something about that coverage in me and my gender and my skin color that brought another dimension to the story. And that was, I thought, it's those nuances that we have to capture if we're going to know any group of people for who they really are, above the headline of the outside observer, but with some sense of knowledge or upbringing or neighborhood or whatever have you. In other words, when I would do stories about living in the housing project, I could do that because I had lived in the housing project. So, and I knew that the image of it past the young men bent on, you know, crime or whatever, were a bunch of hardworking people just struggling, trying to get along like everybody else. And so occasionally I get to do their story along with the story that the assignment editor might have been thinking about for that day. And stories of interest to women. It's amazing that back then there was hesitation as to whether we should be doing stories about women and breast cancer.
There's really fascinating story in here. I mean, now we think that there's so much dedicated to public awareness of that particular mm-hmm. issue. But you did a story on this, and there was this big controversy because you said, look, what we're saying to women is that you should be examining your breasts mm-hmm. to see if mm-hmm. there are lumps. Mm-hmm. Well, how are you going to know how to do that unless we show how to do that? But the idea that you could somehow show that was just beyond the
pale. We did not ask him to do it in the nude. you know, we had a lovely nurse in a leotard. She was only touching her own body. And yet this became such a hot issue that it went all the way to the head of our company. And the right decision was made. But it was the times and what our concept of what was appropriate and not appropriate in terms of our discussion of women as their rights, their gender, and all of that. So yeah. I became part of that, reporting on that struggle, as well as taking the issue of minority groups who blossomed at different times. You know, we had the Black movement, then we had, you know, Cesar Chavez and the Hispanics finding their way. And now we're covering the Asians emerging. But so all of these were stories that I had a chance to play some part in offering a platform for those people to tell their stories.
And it must have been, maybe it was after the breast cancer story. There's also another great story in the book where there was a man who apparently had so much confidence in you, he was going to have open heart surgery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was very nervous about it. And first he called you and said and told you about it and asked you, well, do you think I should do this? And then he said, okay, well, I'll go and have the surgery, but I want you to come with your camera because I feel that if you're there with the camera, then they'll do a good job.
Absolutely. Dan Corsentini. And he believed that. What I was surprised at is that the hospital administrator and his surgeon agreed, because imagine if anything goes wrong, it's now, you know, on film. We were shooting film back then. And so my favorite photographer and I, Dan, fought for it, and they let us in, and I stood at the head of the operating table as they made those first incisions to open up his chest and take out his heart, and to watch it beat over there in the container where it was placed. And his daughter, the reason I have videotape of that today, because I wasn't smart enough to save it, had a copy of the story that I reported and allowed me to make a copy of it, and talked about her father and his joy at being able to take a trip to Italy, which was the thing that he wanted to do most and what really convinced him he should have the surgery, how he truly had watched on the news and somehow thought that there would be something magical about this. So that was an experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, sure. You have had the opportunity to talk with a lot of really famous, celebrated people, both people who are celebrities in the popular culture sense and people who are really important in American politics. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that strikes me is that it was really – you had the opportunity to do this at a time when it was much easier to get close to
yes.
celebrities, that they're much more guarded now. And the idea that you – by virtue of the fact that you were in the news media, mm-hmm. but that you could sit down with all of these people and that they would talk to you. And sometimes when you see some of those clips, you just think it's just out of another time.
Yeah, truly. I mean, in the first place, you know, I call it media gone wild. That's where we are now. There were so few people who were, you know, asking them to do things. The media trainers hadn't grown a mountain of an industry in telling people and coaching them on how they should talk to us and what they should say. Nothing's left to chance anymore. You're coached on everything, and the business itself is managed in a way. Back then, if you got a really good interview and you're on the 6 o'clock news, you could maybe run a story 4 or 5 minutes long. Until later, before I got out of the daily news business, some stations required that all stories had to be under a minute, 30 seconds, no matter what they were about. And that even creeped up into the network levels after time. So I was in the golden age. It was when Bill Cosby is one of the people on the cover of my book because he wrote the foreword for it. But it's when I could meet a Bill Cosby, you know, and have coffee with him and by himself. And, of course, he wasn't as famous as he is now. But there were people who, I mean, like Sinatra, mm-hmm. that he would take on mm-hmm. an unknown, you know, Black woman for the one interview he was going to give that evening. That would be hard to happen today. Or that Ted Kennedy would trust enough that he would fly in a helicopter with me along to do a story about Native Americans. And at that particular time, he had a great interest in it. And he knew I had been reporting on the plight of Native Americans. And to have, you know, an intimate half-hour ride with him with just us chatting is something that would be hard for anybody who was then on the way, you know, to being president to have that happen.
So you first met Bill Cosby when he was quite young and he was just starting to get established doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. I think it was certainly before I Spy and before he became a big star. And he lived in the Bay Area and watched you on television. I guess he was a fan.
Yeah. And, you know, but before that, when I met him, I was at the Black radio station. That's where I first met him.
Oh, before he was on television.
Well, he was just a nutty guy that needed to have people laughing all the time. And so he came over to my station and did promos for my radio show in the early days. And I told him, I'm still Bill, standing on your shoulder, when I called to ask him if he'd allow me to have this foreword put in into my book. And, you know, he's just a helpful person. And you did meet people that you became lifelong friends with. Leon Panetta is another person I met when I was quite young and doing all this, you know. So it's very, very nice that you can say, you know, the man who done da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. But I met him when he was, of course, first starting out also. So all of those things are things that I don't think could be duplicated today. I guess a few network people get an opportunity to build personal relationships with the famous, but not many. Yeah.
You mentioned that your husband is he's a photographer, so he's also in the news business, and so you're a two career household. Mm-hmm. What sort of difficulties did you have, and you're also a mom, you have children. What sort of difficulties did you have in trying to balance your work and your family life?
Very difficult. But I married absolutely the right man. When I landed the job in television, my husband, who quit his job and became a stay-at-home dad long before we knew anything about stay-at-home dads, because we both understood that I'd been given this opportunity and we had to make the most of it. So that's how we handled the first years, because he did not want me to worry about, you know, whether my daughter was 2 or 3 years old then, what was happening with her. And then a few years later, when the opportunity came for him to get into the business, then it became competition. We were so competitive one with the other. We did not share information. In fact, we had one phone in the house that whoever was using it had the right to privacy while talking on it to their station.
Well, so you and he worked for two different stations?
Yes, we worked for two different stations the entire time. We were competing with one another. And that was kind of fun. We did have one time that a big story was happening right in front of our, down the hill from our house, and our children were there. This fire is raging, you know, it's Standard Oil, which is now Chevron, and we're home. We have one car, two kids, big decision night.
Who's going to go out on the story? Did you flip for it?
We both went out, and the children went too.
You loaded them in the car and you went to cover the fire.
We were competitive.
Well, you know, I think there was a time when I think that CBS, the network, was looking at you with some interest. And it would have meant that you would have to leave California and go out to the East Coast. And apparently you said, no, you're not gonna do that.
We went there convinced that it was going to be our next move till we saw the reality of it. The system is set up so different. I mean, I'm friends with everybody in my market. When women finally came into the business, I had the dinner at my home to welcome them to the community. And that's the kind of environment. New York was totally different. And we both could tell by our own, you know, our style of working that this was not going to be for us. So we were due back for the final interview to find out whether I'd be really given a job. And we looked at each other And we just, because our luggage was in the car, we were going to go there and go there. And we just told the driver, straight to Kennedy, please.
Wow. And it was because it was just so much more intensely competitive.
Competitive. And with two children and two people working in the news business in New York City, you know, two kids who need somebody. Would that mean leaving their grandparents and leaving all their friends and associates? We decided not to do it, and we think that was the best decision we could have ever made.
You have had the opportunity to talk to so many people, and I'll ask you this question, and I'm going to ask it knowing that I hate it when people ask me this question. Mm-hmm. Are there any particular people that stand out in your mind as being the people who were just the most personally impressive, powerful, magnetic, inspiring that you've had a chance to meet?
There are a ton of those people. I mean, truly, truly, a ton of those people. But in order to answer this question, I took a different barometer. And what I said to myself, I mean, there were many black leaders. I mean, I interviewed all of them at one time or another. Women leaders who I admired greatly for their courage to stand on the line and believe in what they believed in and, you know, and put their body and their whole family and wealth on the line. But the interview I mentioned about Bobby Kennedy was different and stayed with me because it was a heart-to-heart talk. Not really a microphone in your face, but I'm a reporter and he knows. Mm-hmm. And it was about changing, about his belief system early on and the change within and how he now was refocusing his life and how he now knew that his job was to take care of those who couldn't take care of themselves. And not that he didn't know it all the time, but that was the main point of what he saw as a change. And, you know, a reporter who sits around when a major person like that is talking to you as though you were a friend about their most intimate feelings is an unusual thing and something to treasure.
I've mentioned here that a couple of times mentioned that you wrote this book about your experiences in life and in journalism, Never in My Wildest Dreams. And the title says a lot right there. And I know this is something that you worked on for a long time and sort of started on and then put aside so that it was not an easy thing probably to do, to work through all this. Would you say that there were some things about yourself that you learned or maybe understood better as a result of the exercise of doing this book?
Here's absolutely, I mean, I absolutely had not thought about consciously much of what is in what I call the early life chapters, because they were not things that I wanted to remember. And it took lots of prodding. In fact, you see that there is a co-writer on there, a woman named Vicki Haddock, who is a newspaper editor, basically, and a writer, fine writer. But her reputation, having worked at three different newspapers in town with my women journalist friends, was that she's one of the best editors in the world. And so she would always push me farther than I was willing to go. She would always make me go the next step over something that sounded interesting, but that I was pulling back from. So without her prodding, I don't know what I would have done to get the intimate side of it. And without her sharp editing eye, I don't know whether I'd been able to release the many people who I wanted to say thank you to who had helped me along the way. And so it was hard for me to lose them, too, because it was like losing, you know, one more child. You really mean I can't keep this paragraph in here about Chuck Patterson. He was such a great guy. Why do I have to lose that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like therapy, the best I could say. You know, and with somebody that makes you go where you had never planned to go in a public way.
You've been doing now for 19 years the show This Week in Northern California at KQED. And I guess it's my understanding that it's a program. It's kind of like, if people have seen Washington Week in Review, it's kind of like that.
Yes.
Where you talk with other Bay Area journalists about what's been, what's in the news that week. So you're you're going to go, I think, through the election, and then you will be retiring from that. Well, then what are you going to do? What do you want to do?
That's why I gave myself 6 months or 7 months to think about it. I don't know, but I don't think that unless I can get a trainer, that I can get rid of this kink in my life that says, you know, you want to know everything, you want to do everything. And I don't expect it just to die overnight. But I'm hoping as I work through the process and say this often enough, that the passion that I have for the news of the day will not die, and that I will find some way to utilize that, that it would serve as some helpful purpose.
Any particular story that you're really just itching to tell?
Well, you know, I'm not so much itching, but because I've now brought it to almost a point where it's not that unusual. But I was fascinated by one story is our president's story. That story I don't think I'll ever get, but, you know, it's still out there. And that means an interview with Barack Obama. But I became interested in something called the Three Strikes Law. And that story, I had a hard time selling it to every editor in every newsroom. And not every, because it wasn't that many times, but to every editor. They people just didn't see the benefit of it because, after all, these guys had done something wrong or they wouldn't be there. But there was something so unfair about it. There is something so unfair about it that it will finally go to the ballot this year. And we will see where the public stands on it. And it's interesting that the son of the man who was the proponent of getting that act into law is working to repeal it.
Yeah. I'm sorry we have to stop. I wish we had more time. If you'd like to read more of the story of our guest, Belva Davis, you can look for her book, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. And it's now published in paperback by Barrett Kohler. She's visiting the campus. Thanks very much for talking with us.
This has been a pleasure. No wonder you've sat in that chair so long.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
On tomorrow's Focus, intercollegiate athletics began in the U.S. in the 1850s, but it wasn't long before people were talking about the need for reform. Penn State historian Ronald Smith says the story of big-time athletic reform is generally one of failure, in large part because it ignores the one group that has a direct interest in reform, and that's the faculty. We'll listen back to a conversation from our archives with Ronald Smith, author of Pay for Play, a book that explores the history of college athletic reform. That is in the 10 o'clock hour of tomorrow's program. Then at 11 o'clock, a conversation with Dr. Gar Alperovitz, who is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, about his book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. On Thursday, a conversation about drunk driving with Dr. Baron Lerner, an associate professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And he's written a book called One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with Dr. Laurent Dubois, the professor of Romance Studies and History at Duke University, about Haiti. He has a book called Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, which looks at the ways the country's past continues to shape its present. Those are the topics on the next couple of days of Focus, all interviews from the archives. Hope you can tune in and join us for that. Coming up on the Afternoon Magazine, among the stories we're keeping an eye on at this hour, retired judges suing over a new law that will begin charging some state retirees for health insurance. Indiana students made modest gains on the state's I-STEP tests last school year, and regulators have frozen the accounts of an Iowa-based brokerage with offices in Chicago because they can't account for more than $200 million in customer funds. We'll have details on those stories in just a little bit. Also, we'll tell you about a really unique creative reinterpretation of what you may know as the Scottish play, Macbeth, featuring actor Alan Cumming performing as Macbeth, as Lady Macbeth, as Macduff, as just about every character in the play. That's all ahead. Stay with us. Let's get an update on the commodity markets at this hour, starting with Kansas City wheat for July at 818. That's up one half. September wheat at 830 and three quarters, up one and a quarter. Chicago wheat for July is at 812 and three quarters, up two. September wheat at 830, up one and three quarters. July corn's at 766 and a quarter, down nine. September corn at 724 and three quarters, down seven and one quarter. July soybeans are trading at 1660, down 5. August beans at 1593, down 13 and 3 quarters. July soybean meal at 483 even, that's down 250. August soybean meal at 469.60, down 440.